Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 602 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. I'm recording this intro a little bit early this week because I will be on the road to Miami when this would normally come out. Speaking of which, my guest today is going to be Walter Mosley, an interview conducted in partnership with Miami Book Fair. His latest book is a delightfully strange science fiction called Touched. This is the weekend of Miami Book Fair, where many, many, many authors are going to be appearing. And this is going to be the 40th Miami Book Fair. Before I get to the interview, I would like to congratulate my friend Jamie Hecker on the publication of a new book called Disney Legends, Makers of Magic, Volume 1, with a foreword by Didier Gaz. Both of them have been on the show before. Let's talk to Walter Mosley.
And now, the interview of the day.
Well, today I am very lucky to be speaking with Walter Mosley, who's the author of over 60 books. Besides being prolific, this is totally unfair, he's also a great writer. And his latest book is called Touched, which is science fiction fantasy trip that is one of the most delightful books I've read in a while, despite the fact that it's got some dark material. Nevertheless, I really fell in love with the story. And this is a book, if you have 2 to 3 hours to just sit and read a book, it's so satisfying. Thank you for giving me some time, Walter.
Thank you.
So the story begins with the character waking up with what seemed to him to be new revelations about what might be his true identity. And I find this kind of wonderful, this game that you managed to pull off, which is he crazy or is this just a different reality that he's waking up to? And I think you keep the question alive enough without being coy, because that would be really frustrating. Mm-hmm. If we got to the end of the book.
It has to be real, right? You have to take it. Well, I'm looking at it from this point of view. And you know, it depends on who you are, what you think is really happening. I love that in books, when you can do it. You're right. You don't want to cheat the audience, you know, with some kind of cheap trick.
I remember what Stephen King wrote in Dance Macabre, where he's like, if you're a horror writer, you have to show the monster. You can't just hide the monster for the entire story. At some point,
yeah,
you owe the reader. And so the book definitely has a stance that, no, this is real, probably. This is one of those books where I can't imagine, how does a book like this get started? You're famous for writing detective novels, which they're great. You write a lot more than that as well. But a detective story, the inciting incident seems like it's, once you have that, then it all follows through. Where this one, I'm bumfuzzled. Okay, how does someone write this book? So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about just how this started and how it became a book.
This started like many books that I write start, not all of them, but many. I just started writing it. Guys waking up. He feels like he's been asleep for 1,000 years. He's really, that sleep has been so much more than 1,000 years that it's ridiculous. You know, the exponentiation, you write the number, like let's say a 9, and then above it to the right, you put another number, and that's how many times that number is multiplied by itself.
Yeah.
Did you know that you can, there's one on the other side? Instead of putting the little number behind the big number, you can put it in front of it. And that one is so much more than exponentiation. I was watching a guy talk about it. He says, yeah, it means that there's 1,000,000 zeros behind that number. It's like, that's how much longer it is than the 1,000 years. One of the things I like to do when I'm writing science fiction is not make humanity the central topic, making them good, worried about whether they survive or not, all that other stuff. And this book, it's the same. Some other creatures, much more powerful than us or more powerful than our imagination, have decided that the chromosome is a problem and they need to solve that problem. And so they've sent a series of 107 agents to Earth, unknown to these people until that moment. That's what I was thinking. It's a very big thing. It's a whole bunch of stuff. This is a very short book. It's a novella, but there are 107 books in my mind. I've written thumbnail outlines of 67 of them.
Most excellent.
So I'm thinking that there's this really big story, and I have no idea how it works out, which is always useful to not have any idea what the end of your book is, I think.
I teach creative writing, and I've done a fair share of creative writing. I think I do like to know where I'm likely to end up and then get surprised along the way. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I'm not sure you could do that with a book like this, where it keeps getting surprising. So I could definitely see the value of writing as a form of disciplined exploration.
Just to say that, to come at that from another similar place, I really love boxing. I love watching it. Not that it's really a sport, but... And for many years, at least a decade, I've just loved this boxer, Terence Crawford. He's an amazing fighter. And he's fought many people who in the beginning seem to have his number. They know how to get to him. They do stuff. They do this and that. But while he's fighting, you could see him figure out. He says, oh, I need to change. Instead of being left-handed, I'm going to be right-handed. Or instead of going forward, I'm going to move backwards. Or instead of doing this. And you watch it. And he wins every time. He's never lost a fight. And it's really wonderful. And that moment, like if you're a boxer and you're walking into the ring, the best thing you could possibly do is have an idea of what you're trying to do, but be willing to change completely. Was that Grace Paley said in that last collection of books, enormous changes at the last moment? I love that idea.
Is it because it carries so much freedom?
I think that the great talent and maybe curse of humanity is problem solving. Mm-hmm. You have to solve that problem. The things we love the most is when you watch problem solving in other creatures, in ourselves. You know, say, yeah, you thought Julius Caesar was going to lose that battle with the general Pompey, but no, he turned it around on it. He won the battle, even though he shouldn't have won the battle. You just love that. And I think of that when I'm writing. I'm just like, well, where are we going? How's this going to work? How does it finish? Where are we going to? Who's right and who's wrong? It's just an idea. Science fiction is wonderful because you can start to address all kinds of other impossible problems that exist in what we think is the universe right now.
Yeah. So this is a fairly philosophical book. It doesn't really lose momentum. It doesn't stop everything. Now we're going to have Platonic dialogue. Mm-hmm. It moves pretty quick. Nevertheless, it brings up a lot of philosophical issues. Martin Just is the narrator. He is the protagonist. He's inhabited by another spirit called Temple, although according to his wife, Tessa, no, that's all you. There are different aspects of you, but it's all you. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is brought up is the question of free will. The reason we watch stories, I would argue, is we love to watch people try to solve problems when they learn, when they just take a moment. I recently heard someone complain the movie Escape from New York is boring because as an action movie, it moves really slow, which seems beside the point because... Yes, if you argue it has to be an action movie, well then, yes. But there's a moment early on when he's supposed to track down the president of the United States with a transponder that he has on him. And he tracks it down and a bum is just wearing it. And he has no idea where the president is. He has no idea if the president's alive. And if he doesn't get the president out of there, he's going to die. And he just wanders around this broken, mangled neighborhood. And he lifts a chair up and he just sits in the chair for a minute to try and gather a thought. And to me, that's the joy of that movie is, this guy is, he's an anti-hero. In a normal story, he would be the bad guy or a bad guy. But he just takes a moment to think. I love that. In the case of Touched, we've got Martin.
But before you go on to Touched, the thing about Escape from New York, it's action suspense. The suspense is that the whole fragile, violent world, if the president found, that world is going to fall apart. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to fall apart. And so the thing that you're doing is you're actually worried, if you really take the story to your heart, you're worried about what's going to happen. Where's it going to be? And at the same time, it's revealing a kind of world that people, especially then when that movie was made in America, didn't know could exist. There are prison towns in Mexico now and were at that time. I don't know if the director knew that, but it's believable. You're creating this world, which is just extraordinary world. And you're worried about what's going to happen. And Snake, he really is a snake. He turns it around on everything. So you really do love it until the very end. You're still being, new information is being revealed. And it's not a regular action movie where, you know, the good guy wins or the good guy loses. It's deeper. It's like the historical action films, the Iliad and the Odyssey. But anyway, go on. You were saying about Touched.
Yes. So a major question that for me comes up that you deal with so well is the problem of free will. And you've got this dual personality, Martin and Temple. And Temple is the one who is really aggressive and seems to have a better grip on what the plan is for rescuing the human race. Martin, he's not just along for the ride, and he at times shuts down this other personality so that he can make sure that they're in the right, pointed in the best direction. He's kind of in this compromised position. Early decisions get made where he's not even there for them, even though it's him.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that isn't really satire, it just describes the way our criminal justice system works. The police decide you're guilty of a crime, and then they want to punish you for that crime before you've had a trial, and they're just full of judgment, and the DA's full of judgment. And so they throw him in jail, and he was supposed to be in solitary, but turns out now there's a white supremacist who was being added to his cell. It doesn't go well for the white supremacist, but Martin blacks out. And I guess
Martin doesn't know,
I wonder how much conscious thought went into just thinking about the problem of free will, because if we don't see enough of it, we could tune out of the story. This is one of those stories where I could just see in the hands of a lesser writer, it not working. I was delighted by this book, and I could just see how one or two things could be handled less well, and this strange, wonderful idea wouldn't play out.
I think in the thing that there's the two characters in the same body. There's Martin, who has been around for a long time, and there's Temple, who, when Martin was an adolescent, that's who he imagined he wanted to be, this guy. And so in a way, one of them is the philosophical, you know, movie, if it was a movie, which is Martin, who has certain ideas and certain feeling, a certain kind of commitment to life and to love, etc. And then you have this other guy, he's the action film. He's going to fight, he's going to kill, he's going to torture, do whatever he needs to in order to get where he's trying to go. Not knowing that where we're going, it has to be figured out. It's not like a race where there's a finish line. And so I think slowly, and for me, it's good for the book, slowly, Martin begins to realize his importance in this project. And of course, the action movie always seems more important, but indeed, it's who you are in relation to what you're trying to do. And I think that this is the great beings that have decided this. That's why they've put all these people together to work it out between them, because you can't just do something like destroy the planet. That's not going to work. And they know it's not going to work. They would do it if that worked, but it's not going to. As I think as time goes on, Martin and his family, you become to understand, oh yeah, they are important. And Temple's still important too. He's a powerful figure in this life. And you have Martin's weakness. I mean, the worst thing is Temple knows how to make love to his wife in a way that he has no idea of. He's not that person. And the wife is like, well, you know, no, that is part of you. It's just that you usually don't show it. I think if you identify enough with the character and the character's confusion and pain, you can stay with it. Otherwise, of course, you just like say, well, you know, just turn him off like a not so good television show. That would be bad.
Well, and this is a remarkable portrait of a family. Martin changes, that affects the rest of the family. And I think of stories where that kind of thing happens and the family are treated like props. Okay, yes, it's what motivates so many people is to protect their family, to lead their family, to keep their family in a good spot. These three other characters change and grow too and are literally and figuratively transformed by the experience of what Martin is going through. And I really do feel like the family unit is, their dynamics are growing and changing. They can't be taken for granted, considering all the turmoil that has fallen upon them. They're handling it pretty well, but they keep learning and growing too.
It's so important that because if you have a family, some people we're going through, people have different ages, the golden age, the iron age, so this age, that. My understanding of the world right now today is we're going through the narcissistic age. That's really the fuel of capitalism is narcissism. And so, because that's what it's based on. But if you're not part of that, if you're not a major part of the age of narcissism, then the idea of your family has to be important because it's you. Your family is you. Your children are you. Your mate is you. Your partner. And you really are partners. You really are working together. I'm always writing about that in books. There's hardly a book I've written that doesn't deal with that. And other things, I'm sure you were going to bring this up, but, you know, other things, this whole thing with the Aryan Brotherhood, it's not just the guy that gets killed in the prison cell, but it's also his friends who seek revenge and then are kind of turned to see the world in the way that Martin does, because Martin does things too. It's kind of weird, the things he does to people. And that's another thing. If you get it going right, you can do things, including being political, without really talking about being political.
Right.
Most people who are in a movement don't understand the philosophy of that movement, haven't read the books of that movement, haven't done the thing. They're just a part of it. And that's the best way to understand any kind of intellectual or philosophical or religious movement. Is what are the people like? What do they love? What do they hate? What do they do? And so it was really fun to see. And what you do is you get to see the family and the group of Aryans together, and they have to work together. And that's fun, but you don't want to talk about it too much, because once you start talking about it, it gets really boring.
Well, I did find that to be an exciting part of the story. Outrageous, but believable that they were defeated by Martin and then kind of joined the family effort.
And allowed to understand things about themselves, which put them together with Martin. I was at an event 3 years ago, maybe a little bit more. It was in San Francisco. It was a literary event. I was sitting at this table, and there was a guy sitting next to me. What I always say is a so-called white guy, because white doesn't really mean anything. But he's a so-called white guy. And he's sitting next to me, and we're talking. And he said, yeah, you know, Mr. Mosley, I'm from Georgia, maybe Mississippi. Anyway, but everybody in my family belongs to the Klan. And I went, wow, really? And he said, yeah. And so I'm wondering, what are you doing here? And he said to me, he said, one day I just realized, he said, you know, it's a crock of shit. It don't make any sense. And he said, so I left. So we're in San Francisco. You know, yeah. If you leave that South and go to San Francisco, it's definitely for a reason. It was so interesting to me because we all have the ability to change our minds about things. And all through our lives, we change our mind about politics, about even if we stay who we are, we might change our mind about what that means. We might have one day thought, well, this is really good for me. And then later on said, well, this is really good for everybody. I don't like it, but it's still good for everybody. So I'm still going to do it. And that kind of complexity in human relations, not lifting it up to Kierkegaard or something. It helps because, I mean, that's why people read, so they can think. But they don't want to get bored thinking. They want to have fun thinking.
Again, this is a very fun book, even though so much of the subject matter is upsetting. The story moves on at a clip. And yeah, it's fun watching these Aryans half lose their racism, or maybe more than half. And yet the slurs are still coming out of their mouths. And
yeah, because that's the way they talk. It's kind of funny who they are. The idea, and in a way, that's criticism of the way people think. I'm saying, I don't want you to say these words anymore. I don't want you to think these things anymore. I don't want you to feel like this anymore. It's impossible. And so it's like, you know, one of those things, you can take the boy out of the farm, but not the farm out of the boy, or whatever. But it's true. Who we are is always a process of transformation in who we are and how we are and what we are. And sometimes those things are really good, and sometimes those things are really awful, but they're always human. So I like that.
Well, but on the other hand, this book also raises a lot of questions about the language that Martin uses when he sort of is remembering how long he's truly been alive for and the mission that he has been sent to perform to save the human race by infecting it with his wisdom. And There are times when the idea of humanity is really abstract to him. And he'll say, oh, my template said this. To me, that was one of the... There's no giant block of exposition where it's sort of coldly told. It's always through Martin's voice. But to me, that science fiction work of, okay, what does it mean to be human? Leaving it as a malleable subject rather than, oh, well, we know this and that. Those are givens. And it's like, well, maybe they're not givens. And to me, that was part of the fun of this is how, you know, I thought a little bit of William S. Burroughs and the way he could just sneak in huge ideas and just moving right along.
Because that's how we experience life. That's how the philosopher experiences life. They go off on all these riffs, but the idea is that while you're telling the story, the idea gains prominence because you can see what's going on. And I think great thinkers, you take somebody like Camus writing The Stranger, and you really understand his brand of existentialism. through that. They'll explain it. For instance, when Marceau is in prison, he says, well, the worst experience I had in prison was I didn't have cigarettes anymore. But I learned how to live without cigarettes. And the next worst was I didn't have freedom. He said, but I learned how to look out of the window and see. And so it was really a very human problems that he was facing and solve it. But those are the big things. Because if you can't bring it down from the negation of the negation, whatever people are talking about, if you can't bring it down from that, then people can't learn from it. And that becomes an issue. That's why all of these, you know, major religious texts are stories about how people did this and did that and did this wrong and did this right and were punished and were not punished. And then you understand, you identify with those stories. That's early fiction, but it's still the same job.
So I think I've already established I'm jealous of how prolific you are. Can you talk a little bit about your daily writing practice? What I presume is your daily writing practice or something very close to that, because I think I'm doing okay, but I would really love to pick your brain about how I might do things better. What might your process be?
Well, I don't know if I can answer if anybody's better. And sometimes what is better?
I would like an option to consider.
You got it. Well, no, but writing for me is very simple. I write every day. I look at writing as if it were psychoanalysis in this term. Psychoanalysis was once very important because of all these hysterical symptoms that people had, but people don't have them anymore. So psychoanalysis, it's a practice without a purpose. It can't solve the problem anymore because the problem isn't there. But one of the interesting things about it is you lie down every day on a couch and you freely associate with a little bit of direction from a therapist, not much. They're almost like a spirit. Now, you do it for an hour, and then the next 23 hours happen, and the next day, you realize when you start to free associate again, that all of this stuff has come up from the kind of back of your brain, all of these ideas and experiences from an entire life, all of these memories, all of these thoughts. And so what I understand is, well, if I write 2 or 3 hours every morning, then the next day, I'm going to have advanced pretty significantly, and my story will have grown even though I wasn't thinking about it. And that's day after day after day. If I miss one day, it's going to be hard on me. If I miss 2 days, it's going to be very hard. And if I miss 3, I got to start over again. That's the way I look at it. So, you know, people come up to me and say, I write on the weekends. Every weekend, you're starting over. You'll finish a book, probably, but it's going to take forever. And it probably won't be the best book you could have written. That's what I say. It's not always true, as in some people, it's different. Seminole, it was very different. There's some people. But if I write every day, then I'm going somewhere. And as long as I'm going somewhere, I'm going to get somewhere.
So by starting over, you mean the momentum?
I think the world, because, you know, there's the writing. Well, you know, what did you write? Well, the last thing I wrote is Joe was going into a room and there might be something, some danger in there. So you remember technically what happened, but you don't remember what it feels like. You're not holding on to that passion that you had. And I think that that for me is the most important thing. So you're there and you see what's happening. But for me, what happens is if that ever happens to me, I go, oh, wow, I better go back 50 pages and just read all of it and find out where I was again. And depending on where you are in that book, it might take a lot more than that. So it's a very simple thing, because who one is as a writer might be preordained, but to get the best writing is to keep writing. And I find if you write with real dedicated regularity, it'll make all the difference in the world. It doesn't matter. You have a full-time job as a bricklayer, but you wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you write for 2 hours, and then you go out and lay bricks. That's fine. Matter of fact, laying bricks might help your mind numb everything else down, and all those things that you were thinking will come up from behind you somewhere. Listen, I believe this. I don't know if it's true, but I believe it.
One, it seems like it's worked for you.
It's worked for me, definitely.
And I do want to underscore the importance of what happens between finishing your writing for the day and the next day, because your subconscious is probably getting busy rather than just tapping its foot, so that when you go to write the next day, there's maybe some energy to tap into that connection.
How I feel, it's not just today and tomorrow. It's not just Tuesday and Wednesday. It's Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday and Saturday and Sunday and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday and Saturday. And you go on and on and on and on and on. You're on vacation. You're in the hospital. All these possibilities. And so that 2 or 3 hours in the morning, which to me is the clearest moments for me. A lot of people, it's late at night, but for me, it's the morning. It creates a filter. And so no matter how many other things I'm experiencing and doing, that filter, which is the strongest thing that I've created, is still there. And it's still doing its job. It's filtering. It's saying, oh, this is happening. What does that have to do with my story? Oh, this is happening. You remember that? And you don't know this, but it's doing it. And that's how I feel. Because when I sit down to the story in the morning, I go, yeah, I read what I wrote yesterday and I'm off. I'm ready to write. Okay. And I've been in so many times early on where I would get stuck. Well, what am I saying? What am I trying to do? Honestly, I don't ever feel that now. So if you make that kind of commitment to writing, it's going to be the most important part of your creative life. And you think of all these other people who do it in different ways. I remember Archie Moore had a fight with a guy named Yvon Durell. And Yvon Durell, in the first 2-3 rounds, was kicking the shit out of Moore. The first time he knocked him down, if you said, I'll bet your life against $1 million that he's not going to get up, I would have taken the bet. He was knocked out. But he got up and he kept fighting. And then years later, he was 72 years old and they're interviewing him. And they said, what was it like? He said, well, you know, I used my left hand, which was very educated at the time. That's boxer talk. My left hand was educated. It's not that I was educated. It wasn't that I was looking at him and saying, well, I'll put my left hand here and I'll put my left hand there. My left hand knew what to do. Yeah, back here. But out there in the world. And Picasso, you know, when you watch him getting ready to do a drawing and he does it 300 times, one piece of paper after another, and he puts it into his hand so he could do it eating cheese and drinking wine and talking to his lover. But he's over here doing it. And I think that all of us can do that. Mm-hmm. Archie Moore and Picasso were the best at what they did. But you don't have to be the best in order to do something great, actually.
Have you seen that Picasso? I guess I'm going to call it a documentary, though it wasn't telling his life story, but it was someone figured out how to get the paint to bleed through a canvas so mm-hmm. that he would be painting, but they were filming the other side and then I guess flipping the image so it would look like what he was looking at. But you could watch him paint the whole painting without him being in the way.
Yeah.
And it was mind boggling.
But I love it.
And there are points that I'm like, okay, that painting looks very done. He still had 5 more minutes and it just kept transforming and transforming.
Isn't that wonderful? You can see it in yourself. Most of us don't allow ourselves to go to that place. We're so concentrated on the end product. I did a talk with Ta-Nehisi Coates at Howard just a little while ago. And a young guy said to me, I got the beginning of my story and I have the middle of my story. He said, I'm having trouble putting it together. And he kept repeating it. And my understanding of that problem, because the real problem, I get it, is that the novel is bigger than your head. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it should be. If you can hold the whole novel in your head, then it's not a novel. It's a whole world out there that this person, these people, this epoch is living through. It's so important. It's not even a question of humility. It's just you and your fellow cavemen said, well, we're hungry and we're cold and there's a mastodon down the hill. So we're going to go kill that mastodon. No one of us can kill that mastodon. And that's somehow in our minds, we're that group of cavemen going after this gigantic creature, which could kill us with a shrug.
So how do we solve that problem of finding the ending? I've got my answers, well, but I want to hear yours.
No, I understand. It's to continue the process of writing. I'm working on this novel right now. I love the writer's strike for Hollywood because that couldn't work in Hollywood, which is great. I've written 1¾ novels in the last 5 months. And I just do it every day. And in the beginning, it just feels so daunting. I'm on page 27. I have a general idea of what the problem is, where the answer is and where you're going. But there's all kinds of ways that it might turn on itself. And some of them are good and some of them are bad. But I just keep working. And if you keep working, the novel will work itself out. It won't do it inside your head, but it will do it. And I think that it's really good. And it has to be about the novel. It can't be about being literary. It can't be about the critics. It can't be about some book you read by Dashiell Hammett that you want to compare yourself to. It can't be about, all it can be about is you telling the story you want to tell in the best way available to you.
So you make yourself available to the novel you're writing, and then the novel will let you know when you're done.
Yeah, I'm here. You know, you punch your little punch card and you get to work. And at some point, when you really learn that these things are true, that the novel is bigger than your head, that no novel is perfect, you learn all the various aspects of it inside of you, then the process becomes extraordinary. And people ask me, well, am I going to get published? I said, I don't know. You could write a great book and not get published, and you can write a piece of shit and publish it again and again and again, the same thing. But the point is, it's about being a writer. The reason I know this for myself is true, that when people ask me, because I have a career, I know people, I'm published in different countries and all this stuff. People ask me, they say, well, what's the most important part of writing for you? And it's always writing. So all of a sudden, you bring everything back inside of yourself.
If the writing intrinsically doesn't excite you, there's so much misery just around so many aspects of trying to get published.
Well, that's different, though. That's business, and that's hard. Did you read the thing about in the Authors Guild the other day? There came a thing, something which I already knew, but for some reason, they decided to rediscover it, that the average income for a writer in America is $10,000 a year. That's the average income from a person who writes and publishes and sells and stuff like that. And by itself, that sounds really awful. But the truth is Penn came up with this 30 years ago. And the other thing they realized is all those people who define themselves as professional writers live better than most Americans, because they lived inside of language. They lived inside of writing, and it opened all kinds of other doors in their lives. And I think that's what's most important to me. Somebody comes up to me and says, so-and-so writer sold 2 million books a year and they make $20 million. And I'm going, okay, that's fine. But all kinds of people make a lot of money. If you want to really make money, you go into real estate. You don't go into writing. But the idea is that's okay. That's a kind of benchmark for success. But the truth is, what makes me happiest about writing is writing. For instance, Touched. I love Touched. It's fun. I have another 106 novels I could write. Yeah, I'm never going to do it, but I could write about the same subject and really come at it all kinds of different ways. But I love doing it. I just wrote it. I had no idea that I would sell this book, honestly. And the fact that I did, the fact that Grove Atlantic said, okay, good, fine. Can't really pay you too much for it, but we can put it out there. And I said, fine, let's do it. And really, if I was worried about profitability, about success, about how much money I was going to get, about what is the next step it's going to bring me to, I wouldn't have published a book. I would have just kept it in a drawer somewhere. But I love having this talk with you about writing, about books, about that book. And that's what your life is about, no matter what you do.
Can we return to the idea of the creative filter that you have in the mornings? And actually, there's a specific question I want to ask about Touched in particular.
Okay.
Because I've written two novels. One is in a drawer, not because I don't like it, but because I don't know what to do with it. And then one was published by an indie press. Mm-hmm. And to crank that out, I wrote in the mornings. Every morning, I got up an hour early to put in my time. My teacher, Jonathan Leithan, shamed me. And good for him for shaming me. He had just had a baby. And he's like, I'm getting my writing done. Don't complain to me that you're struggling. And I am not a morning person. So a bowl of cereal, I got some caffeine in me. And now I'm like half robot, half human, trying to write my stuff. But it may have actually helped that I was not my afternoon self, even if I was still kind of waking up, still trying to shake the cobwebs loose. But it was the time I needed to make sure I got the writing done, that I gave the writing the time. So with Touched, it begins with the protagonist waking up from these strange dreams. And I just wonder, can you identify with that, my feeling about my morning spirit? And did any of that go into Touched? This sort of quasi-dream.
I got a little lost there. Did any of what go into Touched?
The sense of the morning being this quasi-dream time. Or for me, I'm not fully awake, which may not describe you at all in the morning.
Well, when you're talking about, you're not like a morning person. That's what you were saying, basically.
Yeah.
For as far as being creative.
I'm not fully awake in the morning.
Like, so what time are you, the best time you're fully awake?
Some days I don't get there.
But let's just say on the average.
10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., I'm awake.
And then after that, it's down again in the evening.
Yeah, starting to power down.
You know, I forget exactly when Octavia Butler wrote, but it was, even if it was in the morning, she would come home, she'd go to bed at 8, and then she'd wake up at 4 in the morning, and then she would write then, because that was the only time that she could get to be alone. Also, I think it was good for her. I think she liked it. I think she liked writing then. And so I always urge people to write at the times when they're feeling their best about writing. Every once in a while, you can do other times. Me, it's almost only mornings. Every once in a while, I'll write in the afternoon. I can't even remember the last time I've written at night. But that's what I would say to anybody, you know, before talking about myself. I'm up in the morning. I'm ready to write. Even if I'm having some incredible, terrible quandary going on. I'm old now, you know, 71. And I'm thinking, I could think, oh, my God, something's wrong with me. I'm sick. And I'll think it and I'll be worried. And then I'll go, oh, okay, let's write. And then 10 minutes into writing, I've forgotten everything I was worried about. I'll remember it when I finished writing. That's the life. And you want to find that if you can. And believe me, there are a lot of writers who hated writing. Joseph Conrad despised it, but he wrote because something else was pushing him. So he was trying to say something. So did I answer this question or did I miss it?
No, I think you did. It seems like you're more of a morning person. And
yeah, I am.
So
yeah.
Your advice is whenever we feel like you might feel in the morning, that's when we should try to get our writing done. My schedule was so overwrought that it's like, okay, even if the mornings weren't the best time, it was the only time I could be guaranteed to get the writing done. And I will say in the afternoon or whenever I went to whatever day job I had that day, I didn't feel anxious. I wasn't frustrated as a writer, even if I wrote some clunker sentences in there, which that could all be fixed later.
Oh, yeah, sure. It never works. It's always getting better, but it never works. It's really true. If I've written in the morning, I don't have anything to worry about all day. If I haven't written, I have something to worry about all day because I'm not writing. And listen, if somebody says they're a writer, that's all good and well. But the question is, well, are you writing? You know, and if you're not, well, then you're not really a writer. Not right now. You might be again tomorrow or next week or last year. But it's something you do. You say, I'm a boxer. You have to be boxing.
Yeah.
I'm a bricklayer. So, okay, where do you work? Well, I work at Walmart. Well, okay, then you're a Walmarter. You're not a bricklayer.
Yeah, I think thinking about writing isn't the same as writing. And worrying about writing, I would say, okay, 15 minutes of thinking about writing is fine a day. But without the writing, one of my mottos for students sometimes is thinking is overrated, just write.
And it's very true. And of course, if you are just writing, you probably don't need to think about it. You go, well, okay. I certainly don't. I'm not thinking about it all day long. I'm not thinking about it. If somebody starts talking to me about a story I wrote, but that's a whole different thing. You start talking about the ideas and technique is interesting because a lot of writers see themselves as literary. And in fiction, this is not necessarily true in poetry, almost every novel that has survived, every short story that has survived was at one time popular fiction, starting with the Iliad and going all the way through Moby Dick. And because, you know, Melville wanted Moby Dick to be popular and it ended up being popular, but he was very ahead of his time. Gogol and those short stories, The Nose, The Overcoat, The Inspector General, all these extraordinary stories. People read them. They wanted to find them. Charles Dickens, he was the most important writer in the world. People would wait for the boat, the things to come in. It's only later on when somebody says, well, he's very literary, he's very this, he's very that. And well, yeah, but even Sis Carey is not a very well-written novel, but it's a very important novel, and it's a very powerful one. That's why I never mind working in genre. I love writing in genre because that's what's popular. Now, you can write a lot of bad books in genre, but you can write a lot of bad books in literary fiction, too.
Well, and the idea, okay, you should be reading this. Why? It's good for you. That's a non-starter for me.
Well, yeah, you should be reading because you love reading and you love what you're reading. I can't read books that I don't like. It might be good for me, but I can't read it.
Well, I remember you gave a reading at NYU one time and someone asked who your influence is. And you're like, well, here's where I'm supposed to say Tolstoy.
Yeah.
And he goes, which he is, but Stephen King too.
Well, actually, I remember I said Jack Kirby. I said Marvel Comics and Jack Kirby because those stories spoke to me. And kids, when they do things like read comic books, kids think and they think deeply and they can't stop thinking. I just remembered when I read about the Submariner and the Fantastic Four and I said, well, he's a villain on Earth, but he's a hero in the ocean. So, and the whole idea of having somebody who's both a hero and a villain was just so wonderful for an adolescent, because that's how you feel all the time. And it's really, but you know, people don't like it. I said, no, you have to read good books. You have to read Shakespeare. And I said, okay. But Shakespeare was unbelievably popular in his time.
He was the Spielberg of his time.
Yeah.
Also, people weren't sitting around reading Shakespeare in his time.
I mean, he didn't even write it. There was things written, but it was just for the actors.
How much revision went into Touched? Because I find it so absorbing and fun. It's a page turner, even though it's in some ways abstract and in some ways it's metaphysical. Although I don't think we don't go two paragraphs without being grounded again. But I just wonder, for a book that seems to be about the subconscious as much as this one is, what the revision process would have been like.
My revision process is always the same. It's very much the technique of doing something that's always gathering things in, like making a carpet. I just do a draft after draft after draft. I go through it. I'm reading it. I'm learning things about it. I'm saying, oh, this is wrong. Okay, that's right. Okay, why did I say this? This doesn't make sense. What's he talking about here? All of that character stuff and maybe 25 serious versions of it. After a while, you know, it's almost every day. Like you can go through a book in one day, and then you can go through it again the next day and the next day. But again, it's bigger than my head. So I'm saying, well, okay, what about this character? Who is he? One of the Aryans. Two of them were hurt and infected by Martin, but one of them actually died and was brought back to life by Martin. So I'm saying, so what's the difference here? That kind of stuff. Because you have to ask the question. If you put it in the book, you got to ask the question. You can't just say, okay, he's dead when people come back to life, like zombies. Yeah, but no. And I'm trying to answer the question, though. A lot of it, it's really very specific thinking inside the story of the novel. And if I can make that work, I can make the book work. That's basically what I'm thinking.
Well, I love your drive for excellence. And every book of yours that I read is quite a ride. I think Touched is a fine contribution to the Walter Mosley books on my bookshelf.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I just want to say one thing about the book. Because, you know, I argue with people talking about, well, do you believe in aliens? And I say, well, yeah, of course I believe in aliens. I just don't think they're here. Because if indeed Einstein is right, and you can't go faster than the speed of light, and if you went into a black hole, you would just be shrunk down to nothing, and you wouldn't come out the other side. If that's true, then communication can only happen if indeed the Big Bang is for real. It can only happen then. That moment where everything is just micromillimeters apart. And that was the notion of this book, that these powerful beings could send all this information out because all of the matter of the universe was in the grasp of, like, you know, the palm of a hand. And that's how they did that. It just meant a lot to be able to do it. I went, that's good. So now I'm saying something, and it probably didn't happen, but it's at least it's not fantasy.
That is the show for this week. I would like to thank Walter Mosley, Lisa Pally, Miami Book Fair, and Isaiah Portillo for editing this episode. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, Heartbreaking Comic Book Reviews, Heartbreaking Comic Book Reviews by Drew Barth, and of course, Discussions of Cinematic Masterpieces by Jeff Schuster, who is the curator of Schlock. Until next time, gang, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.